everyone. Welcome to This Is Whole Life. I missed you. Very much I missed you.
And we missed you.
We missed you, bro. Welcome back.
Thank you. Every so often, one of us ends up going on vacation and, you know, things roll on without us. And I did have just a brief chance to kind of read through the transcript before my flight took off. And I saw that you guys had a good start. I do have to listen to it, though, because I haven't had a chance to go back and do that. And actually, okay, real quick, before we do the whole introduction thing, I got a shout out. Heather was listening last night. She couldn't fall asleep. She was kind of feeling weird yesterday. And she was still up at 1:30 when I went to bed. And she's like, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to listen to the podcast.
That'll put me to sleep.
And she did say a while back, though, that she said, you know, you really should preface it if you haven't told them why it puts me to sleep. And I said, well, I told them why. And she's like, well, yeah, it's the sound of your voice. But when we were first married, I used to read to her a lot. And it used to eventually it just got to the point where either I wasn't that interesting, the content wasn't that interesting, or it's just that.
Or it was just very soothing.
Yeah, or yeah. See, thanks, Melanie.
You're welcome.
We need a female in the room to say the thing I didn't want to say.
Oh, that's me.
So I appreciate that very much. Thank you. In case you are wondering, you've listened this far, This Is Whole Life. Every week we dig a little bit deeper into the message that is being presented from the week prior. We've had a chance to kind of sit on it, think on it, digest it a little bit. Even if the person giving the message said there wasn't really that great of an answer to start with, which I'm not sure I agree with, but also I agree that I didn't want to be the person having to actually preach the message either. Because, you know, we've been, what are we, heaven and hell? Are they real places? Should we see them as such? Or is this basically mythology that was brought into the time of the writing of these scriptures? And so we should assume maybe they could be something else. This one is, how come we just don't get to have like 400 or 500 wives like David and his sons or son, at least? I mean, he's the one, he had the most wives, isn't it?
Solomon,
right? Wasn't that it? I think in the Bible, does it say that? Or
yeah,
just
he
assumed?
Had like 700 wives. That's and 300 crazy. Concubines or something like that. It's,
I mean, if you think about that in the terms of days of the week, I mean, is that even possible? All of this?
I guess that would be one framework you could work from.
But I mean, just to not that, yeah. But to just like, how do you know how many are your wives? Who would you know if you went through, walked through the castle? How would you possibly know?
You have to wear like name tags or something.
Right. Do we have identifiers or how do we know?
Well, I guess if you put that in context, on a average Sabbath here at Whole Life, we're looking at about a little over 700 people attending.
Wow.
So
yeah,
that's just
that's all I'm saying.
Knowing
how
the names
track?
Of every single person that.
I mean, yeah. I guess maybe it wasn't that kind of a relationship where everybody like, hey, we're sitting down to family dinner.
Meet you in the great hall.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, kids, put away your iPads. We are having family dinner.
That's right.
Ben, pay attention there, half mile away from me at the end of the table.
Service for $8.50. That's the thing is when those numbers are staggering, and maybe that's over an entire lifetime, but either way, that's just I hadn't listened to the message until this morning, just because I was like, no, I'm going to be gone.
We're proud of you for that, Randy. Everybody to do that when they take vacation.
I did a pretty good. I was proud of myself. Did pretty good. The only time I kind of wavered was I was telling my father-in-law and my mother-in-law about the Helen Heaven's sermon. And compliments from my mother-in-law. She said, great sermon.
Oh, thank you.
So I haven't heard her.
Thank you, mother-in-law.
That's right, Jane. We encouraged them to listen. And then he had the Scooby-Doo video. So we had to do it. And he's like, oh, Scooby-Doo. He's like, that was genius.
I think that was everybody's favorite.
Yeah, I think it was. I don't know. The first one, Wetmore Stop.
The Wetmore. Yeah, that one. That's the one I was actually. Yeah, there you go.
Mission Impossible.
You've been listening to the wrong podcast. Yeah. That's a backpack, not a. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't hardly beat that. So, as I was saying, every week here at the Whole Life Church, we get together and we talk about these sermons. And this was the third and final. That's it, right? There was no more.
Did we introduce everybody?
Oh, we didn't. I'm Melanie, Ken. Go for it.
Hi, I'm Melanie.
Ken.
Hi, I'm Ken.
Lucas. Hi, I'm Lucas.
He didn't even wait. Hi, I'm Randy. And this happens every week. It really does. So tune in every week to catch all the fun. What is the so it was heaven the is heaven hell real place
heaven and hell yeah
and then it was
how do we interpret Romans 12 yeah. Talking about our relationship right. to government
and so and then I know we had some feedback was the one that you wanted to talk about is that from that message
I think it was kind of from that week yeah.
So do you want to start? Because I've got one from that message too.
Oh, okay.
Because
sure.
I didn't realize that Lucas didn't get emails from podcast@wholelife.church. So he did not know that there were responses in the inbox last week. So if you want to start with yours, I'll follow with mine. And
sure. I think Melanie and I both have received a couple questions about why.
Okay.
On that Sabbath, we didn't talk about Charlie Kirk
okay.
And his assassination. And, you know, in retrospect, for me, I wish we would have had a prayer for his family. They're having the memorial service, and for whatever reason, it just with the week, whatever, we didn't think to do that. I think the other part of it was the reason I know I didn't include anything in the message was because I didn't want the message to become about Charlie Kirk. I had a message that I wanted to talk about when it came to answering the great question. It feels like anything that that brings up Charlie wound up being about Charlie. As opposed to being about that particular message. And I just wanted it, I wanted to talk about our relationship to government without people having huge feelings either way about it.
Well, it's almost impossible to not have it be about Charlie if you're going to talk about it, right?
If you bring him into it, it becomes more about that.
Yeah, and, agreed.
And so for me, that's why it wasn't in the sermon, why we kept it to that particular thing. And, you know, with that said, I definitely want people to know, you know, I've been praying for Charlie's family, his, you know, his wife, his kids, just horrific. I'm such a big believer in free speech. I'm such a big believer that everybody has the right to say and believe what they want to say and what they want to believe. And, you know, as long as they're not hurting people, as we talked about in that particular message. And so so definitely been praying for that family as they're going through that difficult thing. And I think, you know, there have been so much political violence, so much, and so much violence in general. We had the, as we're sitting here today, we could talk about the shooting in Michigan at the Latter-day Saints Church that left, I can't remember how many dead and—
Plus loss of a building. Yeah. I thought it was a fire when I saw it on the news. I didn't
Well, it was a fire, but it was the true tragedy is the loss of life there. And another, and there were just, that was one of, I think, five shootings on the same day of mass shootings. And a mass shooting is described as four more people are shot. That was that particular, on that same particular day as the shooting at the church in the Latter-day Saint Church in Michigan, there were four other shootings that qualified. And, you know, it's getting to a point where it's almost difficult with everything that's going on in the world to mention everything and that's going on. And when you mention one thing, then you're questioned why you didn't mention another thing. You know, we didn't mention the shooting, the political shooting that took place of Melissa Hortman and her husband, where they were murdered in their home.
That's Minnesota, right?
We didn't really mention that in our church service and either. So it's a difficult thing as we're going through trying to decide, okay, you know, how do you decide? We've got a certain amount of time for a worship service. So what needs to be mentioned and what doesn't need to be mentioned. And, you know, sometimes we make, I think most of the time we get it right. And I think sometimes we get it wrong. I hope those who listen to us know that our hearts are in the right place, that
Absolutely.
We, genuinely care about our world. And, again, with all the information, all the, things going on, it can be very difficult to always decide, okay, this is something we should talk about. For those, you know, who pay attention, I did mention the Charlie Kirk shooting during my 60-ish, the day after that it happened. Yep. And then the Sabbath right after that was our community service weekend. So we didn't have normal church services that weekend. And so.
But we did have a prayer where we specifically talked about violence and asking God for tender and vulnerable hearts with empathy for people. So I think if you draw some of the lines between what we say in our prayers and when we're talking at church and events, you can pretty well tell how we feel about these different things, without us necessarily saying things explicitly.
I think it's a challenge too if you're gonna take up worship time for some of these that just don't feel, you know, no matter which side of who could have been or what tragedy could have happened, that sometimes it just doesn't feel right to be in the worship like you did the 60-ish and right after it happened, and some of those different pieces or where you put it out seems like sometimes it seems almost more appropriate than, I'm not a big fan. I saw a lot of churches did a lot of time about Charlie, and they before that they had done some others with, I think the Minnesota couple that you mentioned, and the were they Senate or the I think
yeah,
they were
Melissa
in the Senate,
Hortman.
Hortman, yeah, and that's and maybe it's just me that it could be just a personal thing. I just kind of want to come to church also knowing that that's heavy on my heart, but and maybe talking to other people about it, but not necessarily having it be part of my worship service. But that's just me.
It's like I said, it's the decisions are difficult on what to, you know, what to say or what not to, and when to say it. So pray for us as we're making those decisions. I think it's easy sometimes to read into the decisions as to this is somebody's political leanings versus these are not their political leanings. And so, you know, you can read what I would just hope is that people have grace and understand that you might be right, you might be wrong, about what our political leanings are or aren't. You probably, I think probably be, well, who knows? Anyway, you know, we do our best to make this about God, about Jesus, about the things that we believe the gospel is about, which is we believe the gospel is the good news of Jesus, that he has come to this earth, that there is new life in him. And we also believe that it's our responsibility to care about our world and the people in it and those who are vulnerable and those who are who don't have a voice that don't have the same voice or that others do. And so that all goes into it. So, you know, we'd like to think we're followers of Jesus, not followers of a particular party or thing. We all have our preferred form of government. You know, in this country, most of us would probably say we prefer democracy. But there are those who prefer other things out there. And throughout the course of history, there's a lot of different governments that are out there that Christians have had to operate in and be a part of the society of governments that haven't always been kind to them. And what becomes most important is to be a follower of Christ first.
Absolutely. We also, during that week, we had a question come through from email from someone, is their name. And they had a question. The subject was question at the end of second service, said that they had two observations, and that one was our society demands, or we think we have to love this or hate this, or we have to condemn this, or we have to fully validate this. But replacing this with the political figure or issue of your choice, we never stop to consider the and. We can agree with this aspect of an issue or political figure, and we can disagree with other aspects of an issue, political figure. We need to spend more time on and. In my observation, most political figures and news commentators play on our emotions. They tell us what a person is, a liberal, a left, a far left, right wing, a conservative, a Nazi, a fascist. They do this because the more divided we are, the more power they maintain. The more we condemn someone for the label applied to them, the more we hate and the less we listen to each other and have real conversations. We should never fear conversations. We should never lose friendships because we don't agree with someone's labeling. Sadly, this seems to be the world we live in. Praying that I can be more than that.
That's really beautiful. And that was from an online listener.
I didn't say where, just they used a an email that they were sure to just be anonymous and label themselves someone, which I can, I like it.
Yep.
And I totally agree. If we just maybe spend a little more time in the conversations and that'll work out. And then Randy, we have, I've missed you. It's been a couple of weeks since we've heard from you and I was just in Wisconsin for a little bit of time, and can I say that the weather was, other than the first day when we flew in and landed in Appleton Airport, it was 2 degrees warmer than when we left Orlando, but with 58% humidity, it didn't feel like it. It felt really good, and a whole couple hundred miles on the Harley at like 68 degrees in sunshine and a few cumulus clouds.
Do you have to wear a parka?
I just see the glow coming off of Randy right now.
Well, I'm just now my forehead has done the first peel. We're getting ready for second peel, so it was a good day. So this is just a bit of an update for everyone from Randy. Spring is in full swing with the early flowering trees and flowers coming into full bloom. Daytime temperatures are between 18 and 22 degrees. What's that mean, Lucas? Real temperatures.
I'm still having a hard time doing the.
I thought you could convert that. Because 18 and 22, and then nights.
I think that's in the 60s.
Nights are wonderful sleeping temperature between about 7 and 15 degrees Celsius. Myra's back here in Australia, and I'm so happy she's here. Our cats are in the last few days, but their quarantine should be home by the time we release this week's podcast. And for the coffee crew, oh, that's me. Thanks. I found a wonderful roast at a local roaster, Roses Blend. Just wonderful. Come on over and we can share as much of it as you like. Oh, this excites me. Oh, and the coffee machines for home, they are just next level. Man, this email just keeps getting better. We are looking forward to having everyone here for episode 500. Laugh out loud. I hope this finds you and the rest of the podcast team doing well. Share my greetings with everyone. All the best, Randy. Thank you.
Down under.
Randy, I kind of wish you could see this because... three of us have our phones pulled up to...
These guys are trying to help me out.
To Celsius to Fahrenheit calculators.
So
I wasn't too far off. Yeah. 64 to 68.
Oh. Yeah, see, that was what I was just having there for just a couple short days. And one good friend in a rented Harley Davidson later, and boy, it was all smiles. All smiles. All right. So let's get down to business this week. How many wives should we have? Was that the question? No, the question was, God commanded us not to commit adultery, yet not only did he seem to condone multiple wives in ancient times, but he also told David in 2 Samuel 12:8, I gave you your master's house and your master's wives, and if it had been too little, I would have given you more. How then do we reconcile these two examples by God? On the one hand, we're supposed to not commit adultery. And on the other hand, he practically handed David adulterous relationships.
Great question.
That is a great.
It was.
That I think, what's past great? I mean, I don't know. Next year, I feel like this year's
greatest.
I feel like we kind of graduated this year a little bit. I mean, not that the questions always haven't been good, but I...
You know, given our theme next year, maybe we should change it. Instead of great questions, maybe it should be greater questions.
You know, I think what we should do, I think we should do next year. I think we should have, it should be a full month, so four sermons. And I think we should go I think Melanie gets to pick one for me. I get to pick one for her.
Oh, yeah.
I think it should be back and forth. I think that's what I think. What do you guys?
Okay, let's see.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, it's carried. That's my Sharpie gavel.
And I will be happy to pick up all the responsibilities of the worship pastor for the week beforehand. Oh.
All right, you're on. Let's do this.
Ooh. All right, you heard it here first, guys. I mean, this is breaking news before it even hits the airwaves. It's right there. So, out of all the stories in the Bible you could have chosen from, why David and Bathsheba.
Because that's the text they used.
Oh, was it that one? In 2 Samuel, they did say that. Yeah. Was there a better one?
A better story?
That could have been that for the topic at hand. I know. So if you're trying to stay with what they gave you, would there have been another one had you, if they didn't say, well, they could have talked about David, I guess that was the point. But if, was there another story that you could have used that would have been any different, that would have maybe tilted the scale left or right?
I think you could have, if you're specifically sticking with the discussion of polygamy, there's Solomon that you could have used. There's Abraham that you could have used. But I think David is definitely the easiest, the most go-to, the most accessible one. And I think what makes it interesting is that God calls David a man after his own heart. And yet you see David doing some things that we're going to find out in the New Testament that God doesn't seem to want his people doing and his leaders specifically doing in the New Testament. We see that. So it was truly a good question. It was a great question to ask. And it's, like I said at the beginning of the sermon, I don't know that it has a great answer. It's one of those ones that kind of sometimes can leave you scratching your head a little bit because, late in the sermon, I put out a lot of different theories as to why God, what's up with polygamy, particularly in the Old Testament. You know, is God just okay with it? That's one theory. The final theory is unfolding revelation. In other words, you know, God starts off with his ideal in the Garden of Eden, but then along comes humanity to mess things up. And so then we wind up in the unideal, and then we kind of move on. And by the way, you actually see polygamy occurring before the flood as well. So it wasn't something that was like post-flood. It's before the flood occurs in Genesis. And so you kind of see it go a ways, and God doesn't outright condemn it. He puts, in the book of Deuteronomy, maybe a little bit of Leviticus, there's some ground rules, if you will. If you're going to have more than one wife, you can't marry rivals. You can't treat one better than the other. You can't say that one will, like your favorite one, that if you have a firstborn with your not favorite wife, or that isn't your favorite wife's, you can't give your favorite wife's child the largest inheritance, the double portion inheritance. You have to give it to the legitimately firstborn that you have. And so there's some ground rules there that are put into place. There's some ground rules for divorce, but none of them really kind of come out right and condemn it. And what probably becomes even a little bit more confusing is that some of God's favorites break those rules. Jacob marries sisters who are rivals. He gives the double portion blessing to Joseph when he's dying, and so you have what I would consider to be some very confusing things going on, because on the one hand, God says, don't do this. On the other hand, his favorites do that and don't seem to, you see negative consequences come out of it, but you don't hear God outright say, whoa, 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 you're in trouble. Like with David, David gets in trouble, but David doesn't get in trouble for having multiple wives. There are some theologians don't argue he didn't even really get in trouble for committing adultery, that what he really got in trouble for was murdering Uriah. That's what God was like, okay, that's too far. I appreciate those arguments. For me, I think God is upset about David committing adultery. When I read the language, I see that God includes. He doesn't just say you're in trouble for murdering Uriah. That he says you've stolen Uriah's wife. And there's consequences that come out of that are pretty, pretty rough. So it is a very kind of a head scratcher, if you get at it, it's like, okay, what's going on here? Why this? Why not that? And I think that one of the fun things is when you get into these head scratchers, the ones that are like where you don't feel like there really is a good answer. And there are people who are like, oh, yeah, there is a good answer. Be careful of those people. you know, be careful
Melanie,
of.
Melanie, did you say there's a good answer?
No, she didn't.
I did okay. not, actually. Okay.
She actually very much encouraged me to not just not try to, like, you know, some pat answer. And yeah, and so I think it is one of those things where when you get these kind of questions, it's an opportunity for us to really sit back and evaluate and be thoughtful.
Well, so this leads to a question. I wonder how much of the biblical sexual ethic is about practicality and how much of it is about morality. Because if God is willing to bend for practicality, then is it really about morality?
Bending for practicality.
So I think I'm following you, but for those who aren't as smart as me.
ooh, that's me over here.
I'm actually raising my hand as well. Why don't you describe for us what you would define the difference between practicality and morality?
Well, you talked about the possibility, or wait a minute, I don't remember if you said this in your sermon or if we were talking about it during rehearsal. Anyway, some of the possibilities for having multiple wives might be for population growth or you know, for provision or because of the high rate of maternal mortality, I guess. So if the idea is human flourishing and, hey, here's what God needs in order to cause the population to explode, for example. And so then there's, okay, you can have multiple wives. Is that really an issue about morality or is it more about practicality?
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just asking. I mean, even the big deal about virginity, like if you don't have DNA testing in the Old Testament that I know of. And so it's really important for you to have those really super distinct lines about whose wife is whose and who's been with who and whose child is whose. So were some of those parameters put in place because practically it was very, very important and maybe overlapping with morality or maybe morality is a different issue.
So that's where that's what I think is an interesting conversation too, Melanie, is like, but what is morality? Because generally it's going to be defined as the kind of the discussion of what's right and what's wrong.
Right. Correct. I mean.
And there you
so
go.
And then the question then becomes, well, who defines what morality is, mm-hmm. what's right and what's wrong? Because if you know, there's a number of different, moral lenses that you could use, right? There's Kant. Am I saying that? It's K-A-N-T, right? Kantian ethics. Am I wrong?
Kantian ethics?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
You don't ever ask me to pronounce things, but there's a number of different, I guess what I'm saying is there's a number of different ethical frameworks that you can work from. There's those that basically say, what does the least harm? That decides what's right and wrong. There are those that say, what furthers the human race the most. So what's going to do that? There's other frameworks that are what's best for you. That can be a framework. It's funny to me, and this is actually something interesting to think about. The class in my master's degree program that I struggled with the most, the one that I remember being the absolute hardest one to do, was ethical and moral leadership, where we were going through all these moral theories. And the reason I think I found it so difficult was because all of my morals have been based off of because God says so. And so when you start even in college, I don't remember taking any major ethics classes. It was just basic. Well, the Bible says this, so do this. Don't do that.
Yeah, but you still have, I mean, you have a whole Bible. I mean, if you're like, well, the Bible says this, it's typically going to be a limited number of verses from which you draw that ethic, because you're not going to go back to, you know, well, it says right here, Rochelle, that if you have two wives, you just make sure that you give them both equal or whatever. Like that's not, that's right. not something that you're drawing from to develop your own ethic.
Right. But that's where I guess that's kind of where I'm running though, is that I think what becomes difficult about this kind of a conversation is, okay, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is going to go at this particular, the issue of polygamy from a unfolding revelation standpoint for the most part. I would argue that we actually mix in a little bit of, well, that's kind of because of the time and the place and the culture into it. Now, we get a little antsy with that as Seventh-day Adventists. We're really going to want to do the unfolding revelation one a little bit more, because that one's, well, you know, God just basically over time gives them what they can handle, which to me feels an awful lot like a cultural, well, that's their culture and their time and their place, which becomes a little bit more difficult, because what about our culture and our time and our place? Is God making accommodations for us in our time and our place the way that it appears that he's making some accommodations for some things that are happening, the polygamy and some of the issues that are happening with David and Solomon and Abraham and Isaac, or not Isaac so much, Jacob. So that's what I think becomes interesting about this question, what really makes you have to dig a little bit deeper into the, I think the question you're asking goes kind of along those lines. Is, was this just more of God doing something that was practical for the time in which it was at? It doesn't really have anything to do with right or wrong. And I guess my question back to you, though, is if it didn't have anything to do with right or wrong, then why would God show up in the New Testament saying, okay, now this isn't really a moral issue, this is just a practical one, but now I don't want you to have, I want leaders in the Christian church to only have one spouse.
Well, that's for the exactly the same reason that priests don't get married. Because if you have a whole bunch of wives, then your service to the church is going to have to be squeezed in around the edges. Whereas if you have one wife, you maybe have time to serve the church. So, I mean, even there is kind of a practical issue.
Which priests not getting married, it goes back to the kind of a little bit of the last question, or the question I kind of put to our congregation, is where both Paul and Jesus seem to indicate, well, Paul just outright says it, yeah, I'd rather you be single. Jesus seems to be like, hey, the disciples are like, well, it would be better for no one to get married. And Jesus is like, well,
you're not wrong.
Some people can't accept that, and some can. Blessed are those that can, basically, is what Jesus says. And so now you get into a really, for me, again, it just, it's one, like I said at the very beginning, there's not really a great answer, because what is it that God ultimately wants from Christians today? Is it to be single? Because Paul says that, but yet we don't hear that message being preached a lot within Protestant, within the Protestant faith. In fact, it is largely confined to the priesthood and Catholicism, for the most part. Even in the Greek Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox priests are allowed to marry. And Greek Orthodox will tell you that they are the oldest and the most direct church to the early church, to the very beginning church in Christianity. So what is it? Does God want you to be single? Does he want you to be married? Is it okay for you to deviate into a polygamous relationship if that's just kind of what fits the time that you're in and the place you're in, like David or Abraham? And so in the sermon, we really sought to try to talk about some of the overarching principles maybe of this, and how we can grapple with it a little bit more in our time, in our day, and think about it that way.
Well, the early takeaway from that is, if 500 is not enough, or whatever the number was, that a beautiful lady who, like you said, could have averted his eyes, chose not to, knew who she was, obviously. It's an interesting story when you go and do some of the deep dive into, yeah, like the stuff that you brought up about – You know, he knew who Uriah was, knew who her dad was, grandpa. Like, these were all trusted advisors. This was David thinking he was outsmarting everyone, including God, with this, like, well, now, you know, eventually come back over and okay, now
was
we're
David
good.
Was David actually thinking? Because I kind of feel maybe the thinking part was problematic.
When Ken said he was probably a D on the DISC assessment, and he's like, at least I'm a good problem solver. And I'm just thinking to myself, there's that proud moment where you're like, yeah, I got everybody. No one's going to, you know, I got this all figured out. I got it all wrapped up in this nice little bow.
Yeah, I don't really think that David was trying to, I don't think he was trying to pull one over on people. I think he was pretty blatant about what he did. And I think that sometimes comes up a little missing. We kind of have this picture of David, you know, kind of furtively sneaking over to Bathsheba's house late at night and sneaking in the back door and, or, you know, Bathsheba letting him in or whatever. This is not what happened. David, the Bible says David sent his servants to get her.
Yeah.
There's no indication that it was late at night. There's no indication. It was like David was just basically saying, I'm the king. I can do what I want. That's the way that being a king works in my time, in my place. If I'm the king and I want to sleep with your wife, then you are welcome. I am blessing you. You have nothing to say about this, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
But he wants to play the moral checkers with Uriah. Like he doesn't know what's going on, or maybe he doesn't know right from the get-go, but he's got it figured out before too long.
You know, one way to – it's amazing how when you make a mistake, how you try to justify what you do as helping other people. And I can completely see David thinking to himself, you know what? It'd be pretty embarrassing for Uriah's wife to have a baby for him. And when he was gone, it would, you know, a lot of people would talk about that, about him not being the dad. And so I'm going to help him out so that he can, you know, not lose face. And I'm going to help Bathsheba out by not making her
be stoned to death in the middle of the street for that.
And, you know, so here I am. I'm helping out by doing this. I'm not, again, we can't read.
Yeah,
this, you can read into the Bible a little bit. We don't know, but it would not surprise me at all if that was part of David's thought pattern. Was like, yeah, I get to do what I want to do. I'm the king. That's okay. But this will be really embarrassing for Bathsheba and Uriah. So I'm going to help them out.
Staggering benevolence.
Staggering.
I feel that way to a degree, but then when you add early Uriah conversations and then Nathan, where he's just like, I am appalled that somebody would treat another person that way. And it's like, you know, and then it's like, hey, buddy, talking about you. That's really?
Yeah.
Like, that's me? So I feel like there's a battle that goes on a little bit there when he's just like, no, I think I can just make this all go away and no one's going to know the difference. But yet, I mean, the height of narcissism, you know, in full on full display too, that I'm helping you. Just trust me, I'm helping you.
You know, in one of the research websites I went to, which I didn't include this in the sermon because the website that I was on, I don't know how trustworthy it was or wasn't, but I think it's an interesting thing for the podcast. And so I just threw that out there but I went to a website that was for I think it was a Jewish synagogue, and they were just, I think that they, on the Shabbat, they were going to be discussing this particular story. And the author made an offhanded comment that lined up with something I remember, but I can't place where I heard it before, that in some Jewish circles, Uriah is the bad guy in this story.
Yes. Yes. I read that.
Yeah. That Uriah is like, he should have gone home and done what he was told by his king. He should have saved David the embarrassment. He should have just done the right thing. Didn't matter. This happened. And so Uriah is a bad person for not doing what the king told him to do. And so Uriah is the villain in this story, and he deserved to die for what he did because he had shamed the king publicly. And so therefore he's the bad guy in the story. And that'll make your head explode in today's society from our viewpoint. But for people in ancient times, they might have read it as, here's a guy who's king, And keep in mind, this is not, this is a, there's a lot of things going on here. So honor shame society. The other part of this is that it's a, it's not an individualistic society. In other words, the good of the group is more important than the good of the individual in this society there. Today, most of us live in the United States are living in a individualistic, we think about what's best for the individual. And so in that, and when we look at the story through an individualistic lens, it's, well, Uriah had every right to call David out because David had done something shameful and horrible to Uriah. But in a society that's based on the group and what's best for the group overall, well, what's best for the group is to maintain order and to allow the people who are powerful to maintain their power without being embarrassed and being shamed. And so Uriah did something very selfish by not just, you know, taking one for the team there, basically. And that's another lens that people do sometimes look at this story through, because Uriah is given an order to go home. He's a soldier. He's supposed to do what he's told. And instead he doesn't. And that's why I really do believe Uriah knew exactly what had happened. I think that he wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't think he showed up and was just like, oh no, I think I'll stay here and sleep on the front porch of the palace. I think he very well wanted to make sure he slept in a public place where everybody would know that he had never gone home to see his wife. And when she had a baby, that he was going to be like,
yeah. I always took that in the same way, except that because I think he knew also when he did that he was completely signing his own death warrant. Like, he had to have known that there was going to be major consequences, but at least the satisfaction of, yeah, but I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Well, think about how that story would have played out. Uriah probably would have lived. The child probably would have lived, and there would be no Solomon in the Bible. So.
Ooh, there you go. Thinking about that too. It's funny, this was the first sermon on this subject that I ever was asked to preach. And I rewrote my sermon at 2 a.m. On the internet searching. And when you talked about seriously, I had a totally different, and then I was looking.
Not recommended.
No, it's not recommended, because I had spent like 3 weeks working on this, because No one, it wasn't like coming to Whole Life where someone, they just said, hey, Randy, you want to preach in 2 weeks? I'm going to be gone. You want to take over? Sure. What am I preaching on? David and Bathsheba. And I don't remember I do have the sermon somewhere, but I don't remember what the exact, what end we I came to where they, we were looking for. It was part of a series. But finding on the internet all this information about, like, I had no idea that he knew all these, like, all these were trusted advisors, and that how many people have really strong opinions about Uriah being the bad guy, or David's the whole bad guy. Nobody else has anything to do with it. Bathsheba's totally innocent, or forget it. David was lured in. She knew what she was doing, and she was the bad person. And it's like, the opinions here are really, really, like, if they're in, they're all in. Like, nobody's halfway. Like, well, you know, I guess maybe everybody shares a little blame. It didn't seem like everything I read. So I was really, if you didn't catch the message, if for no other reason, the way that this story is connected with how it all plays out, I found really entertaining, even knowing some of the things that I didn't know Ken was going to talk about, but ended up talking about. And it makes it a very, very interesting story, and something that I've read up on since further, which I don't know. I think it's a really interesting story. And there's just a lot of little nuances that, you know, could be, maybe not, but it's fun to think about and to consider. But
yeah, and one of the other questions that emerges from this story is, it's very specific that the Bible says that a child should not die for the sins of their parents. And yet this child very specifically dies for the sins of his parents.
That was part of the curse, right? On the family?
Or yeah, the baby that the baby from David and Bathsheba's first liaison dies. And the Bible is very specific that God wanted that baby to die.
Yikes. Yeah, I forgot about that part. Oof. That's, man. So we don't have a, this is going to be one where it's, you know, go to your corners and prepare your best and have a vigorous and rigorous discussion amongst yourselves and what you believe God may or may not believe about polygamy.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Sure. You go to your corners. I mean, I think from a...
Is that okay to just leave to think that or where do we leave it when we don't have a good answer?
I think for me, what the authors in the Bible write and what they don't write is really instructive because there's a lot more details that we could have used in this particular story to help us kind of sort things out. So what's the author really trying to get at? And what I think is very interesting for me in the Old Testament, none of the stories of polygamy end well. There's a lot of division, a lot of in-family fighting, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of death that comes out of all the stories the Bible chooses to tell. And for me, I think the Bible, without outright saying it, really heavily implies that polygamy is not a good idea, and it's not a good thing for society in general. And so, that's my takeaway.
Yeah.
What also is a takeaway for me, though, and I think this is also very important, is that God works with us and loves us through our poor choices, through the circumstances we face, sometimes through the things that we don't really understand are wrong, but that they create problems. And by the way, you take Abraham's example. The other thing that you can take away from Abraham, his wife actually gives him her servant to be to bear a child for him. And that's, again, that there's a lesson there about not trusting God to take care of things and trying to do it on your own. So there's a lot of lessons that we can draw that really do help us out that I think we can take away. And yeah, are there times we can go into our corners and say, I think this theory is the best one, or I think that theory is the best one? Absolutely. But I do think that everything for me has to come back down to the idea of who you think God is, what your conception of God is. And because if you want to believe that in a wrathful God, there is plenty of the evidence in the Bible for that. There is a lot of evidence there for that. If, however, you want to believe that God is love, as described in 1 Corinthians 13, 1 John says, just straight up says God is love. If you want to believe in a loving, benevolent God who is a kind and loving parental figure, there's a lot of evidence for that.
Mm, yep.
And the problem becomes which lens. There's a lot of room on the spectrum for which between completely loving God and then despot, really. Wrathful God who just gets to do what he wants to do because he's God. And so if he wants to be horrific, he can be. And so you have to kind of choose what lens you are going to look at the Bible through. And for me, I believe and have chosen to look through the lens of that passage in 1 John that says God is love. And that is who God is. And the reason I believe that is because Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And Jesus matches up for me much better with a God is love than a wrathful, vengeful God when you see the actions that Jesus takes that are recorded in the Gospels. He does not seem, when he becomes wrathful, it's almost always with the religious establishment that's misrepresenting God to the people. Yeah. That's when he becomes wrathful and upset and angry. That's really when you see that when people are getting in the way of access to God, that's when Jesus seems to get very upset. And so for me, that's where it really seems that God becomes the most upset. And you can see it in the story of David and Bathsheba. God seems to get the most upset about the fact that David is representing him. Everybody knows that David is God's anointed. God picked him, a man after my own heart. And I think that what really frustrated God was that this whole incident makes God look like he condones all the things that David was doing, which God didn't. And it makes it look like God's just okay and down with it, which is one of the accusations to this day. Oh, well, and we still hear it. Well, you know, David did this, so, you know, we need to go ahead. And God says, no, no, no. David's a human being. I love him. And what does it mean to be a man after my own heart? Does that mean that he's exactly like me, or does that mean that he's following me, that he wants to be like me? And so those are the questions I think that we have to really wrap our minds around and make a decision on what we believe about God and how that relates to how we treat others. If God is wrathful and vengeful and mean, well, then we get to be wrathful and vengeful and mean to the people we think that God doesn't like. And generally, those people look a lot like the people I don't like. But if we believe that God is benevolent and kind and good to both the good and the wicked, that if he sends the rain on both, well, then that means that I have to go ahead and love the people that are my enemies. I have to care for those who are unkind to me. I have to pray for them. And that is a radical kind of love that I think is very difficult to do. I think it's much easier to hate the people who are our enemies. But that is not what I see coming from Christ. And so really, if we want to boil things down, I think these stories actually help us boil down to what's most important. And then the things that I don't understand, the actions that the authors of the Bible attribute to God, I have to wrestle with that. I have to figure out what's going on there. But I also will always revert back to my cornerstone belief that God is love, and love looks like what 1 Corinthians 13 says.
So, Lucas, did we have any questions? It's the first week back, and I didn't actually write any notes.
Yeah, we got two questions.
Thank you.
Right. If God forgave David and called him a man after his heart, what does he mean when someone says they forgive their partner but keeps bringing up past hurts? Is that true forgiveness, and what does God say about it?
You know, that's without all the details to that, that's a difficult question. Let me do my best at answering what I think is being asked. When we forgive, we do have a responsibility to let go of vengeance. That part we do. That doesn't mean that we have to forget, however, that a knife is sharp. It's you can forgive, but you also need to remember the part that says, hey, I got to be careful here. I don't think it's a very great thing when you keep bringing up the way somebody messed up when they've asked for forgiveness, you've forgiven them, they have taken steps to move on, and they have not reoffended. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of perpetrators of pretty horrific things say, you've got to forgive me because the Bible says so. And once you've forgiven me, that means that all has to go back to the way it was before. And that's incorrect. Yeah. I think I've said it before on this podcast. I know I've said it in sermons. But when you've hurt somebody, you don't get to decide the timeline on which they have to heal. You don't get to decide that they have to forgive you. If you've made a mistake, should Christians forgive? Sure, but there's some things that are pretty deeply wounding, that are pretty horrific things, and there is an obligation on the part of the person offended to take the consequences that come with what they've done. And a lot of us want to say, yo, let's just forgive and forget. Well, forgive, yes. Forget, no. That's not smart. If you forget, well, God forgives and puts our sins at the bottom of the ocean. Yeah, God does do that. And there's also consequences that come along. When you do certain things, there are consequences that come with it. If, you know, just since we're using the David and Bathsheba model here, if you have cheated on your spouse and they forgive you and you stay married, fantastic. That's great. But there might be some consequences that come along with it. Like they're going to say, hey, I need to know where you're at. I need to know what you're doing. I need to, when I ask you this question, you've broken trust. So in order for us to rebuild it, there's going to have to be a little bit more accountability than there was before, because you have not proven to be trustworthy in my life. And that kind of breach of trust is deeply painful. And it doesn't mean that somebody hasn't forgiven just because they say, no, there need to be greater, there need to be more boundaries that go up and we need to have more accountability here. It, on the other hand, if you're constantly telling that person they're a bad person and that they're not a good person, that's also not really always a good method to helping somebody become a better version of themselves. The best version is to be believing in them and to be building them up and to be noticing the forward progress that they make. So again, enormously complicated issue. And my real strong advice is if you're in a deep, meaningful relationship that you care about and there's a massive betrayal, it's a good thing to go get counseling from a Christian counselor and have conversations about what is healthy, because every circumstance is different. And the person who's asking me this question, I do not understand the circumstances that this is being asked from. And so I would want to be very careful about answering something where I really don't have the details on that. But hopefully that broad overview is helpful. And if you do have those big kind of issues, and I would really highly recommend find yourself a good Christian counselor.
I also think when we say David was someone after God's own heart, we're not saying David had God's heart. We're saying he was after God's heart. That implies a little bit of distance. So just because David does something wrong and he's still after God's own heart, that doesn't mean that he's automatically, I don't know, excused or a good representation. It just means after.
Yeah. Sometimes too, I feel like that's kind of the same as when we talk about God never leaves. He never stops chasing us. He's after us all along. So you could really say that about just about all of us with all of the brokenness that we have as well. So I kind of feel like sometimes that one gets to be like, David is the gold standard.
So what you're saying is it was a God after David's own heart.
Well, chasing after.
Chasing after.
I feel it. I mean, I kind of feel like that's that works there. But anyway. Okay, we have one more question, right?
Yes. Nathan's parable comparing David's actions to the taking of a helpless lamb points to a non-consensual act. What biblical evidence supports her conclusion Bathsheba willingly participated in the affair?
That's a great question, and a fair one. The biblical evidence that I would probably use for that is that that she did go with the people who called for her. In the Bible, the conditions where a person was condemned to death or not condemned to death for adultery was that if they were in the city, if they didn't yell out, then they were condemned to death, or if that was it. If they were in the country, then the woman wasn't. So that's part of it. I just would freely conclude that I could be wrong on that, that may not be correct. And
well, if Uriah was a bad guy for not obeying the king, I can only imagine Bathsheba's situation with that power dynamic if she had not obeyed the king. So whereas it doesn't say that David raped Bathsheba, I can't imagine she had a lot of choices.
I hear you, but Uriah actually was willing to die potentially, if he could have been willing to die for that. So again, I'm not here to judge Bathsheba. I do not believe that Bathsheba is the villain in this story. I do not believe that at all. I do think she is a very much of a victim in this story. In the research that I did preparing this sermon, there is debate back and forth on that. So like I said, good people can agree or disagree. And I can see where the writer of that question is coming from.
When I was reading up on this before, it seemed like the people that were maybe thinking she was, trying to entice the king was while she was out on her rooftop. I mean, and she had to have known that there was a clear line of sight. If David could see her, she had to know that David was at least a peeping Tom at minimal. So, or that maybe others were. So maybe that she was enticing, but that was pretty common for people to bathe at the way she did and in the manner in which she did. So I don't think I didn't take it that way either, that it was.
Well, and Ken's point about being in charge of your own eyeballs, I think, is a factor. There, you know, there are plenty of 359 other degrees of space to look at besides the one that's going to get you in trouble.
Not only that, he didn't. I mean, even if he looked, he didn't have to ask for her to be brought to him, right?
Right.
He
could
have
sure.
gone ahead and so. And again, he should have put his eyes where they in a different place.
Well, and there was plenty of places. But,
so there's a lot of that right? going on. But yeah, that's anyway. So, great question.
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay. So that's it for great questions for this year. That's it. And so
we're not answering any other questions.
That's it. None. Except for the ones that you send in every week to podcasts at wholelife.church or that you text or leave. You know, we haven't had a voicemail in a while.
Can send the great questions for next year.
That's it, because Melanie needs an early head start.
Yeah, Melanie would be happy to have a head start. Send your great question to Melanie at wholelife.church.
Or to Ken, if it's one for Melanie.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Oh, dun-dun-dun-dun. I feel like we need a... Carolina, Dave, here's looking at you, buddy. We need a good voicemail, so maybe catch us up on what's been going on. And
No pressure.
No, you know, we've... We just haven't heard from you for a while, so just thinking about you. Okay, so this week, what's happening? Are we on to? No, we're not on to a new series.
Special Sabbath.
What?
Coming up? Yeah. This Saturday our youth are taking over. So we've
the whole
got
thing?
Youth musicians. We have a youth host for our online family. We have two youth speakers. We have a youth drama. We have
the last time we had youth speakers, I remember that it went really, really well.
It did, yeah.
If I recall,
we've got the same quality coming right up. So yeah, we've got some really good insightful.
Chelsea last time, and I don't remember who. Oh,
Danielle,
that's right. Mm-hmm. It was Chelsea and Danielle. They did a great job.
Yeah.
Yep. So we're doing that again.
We are. We've got two new speakers, but we're doing that again.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to be able to snag them for the podcast, do you think?
How late do we want to do podcasts? Because they have school.
I was just going to say school.
Can they do it during Sabbath school?
Maybe. Maybe we can catch them after first.
Maybe. We can ask for sure.
Okay. We'll get in touch. That would be really cool, though, to catch them both on the podcast for the week. That'd be great. All right. Anything else? Anything else that we missed? Anything upcoming that we need to talk about other than Barn Party? I heard Barn Party got a big cheer this week.
We're excited.
I'm excited. There's some cool stuff happening at Barn Party this year. That
Ferris wheel.
This ain't your grandpa's barn party.
Nope. Oh,
sitting at the wedding, which was why was the main reason I was gone the last two weeks and a half. Anyway, we're sitting in the second row behind my brother and his wife, and as they're getting ready to come in, I hear this person behind me saying, we were in Orlando last fall, and they had this, what did he call it? This fall pumpkin something festival or something we went to. It was amazing. They had free chili and hot dogs. And I'm like, I turn around. I'm like, you mean the Whole Life Barn Party? He's like, I know you. He's like, you're on the podcast and you're Maria's. I'm like, yeah, yes, I am. I'm Maria's uncle. And so he had been here.
And where is this at?
This is in Wisconsin.
That's awesome.
That's how legendary our barn party is. They talk about it in Wisconsin at weddings, just so you know.
And he's from Maryland, if I remember correctly. And he was here doing clinicals along with Maria and her fiance, husband, Leo. And so barn party, and I said, man, you should come back this year. It's going to be a Ferris wheel. We're going to have all kinds of fun. He's like, when is it? He's like, I'll ask Maria. She'll know. And I'm like, Maria will know.
It's worth traveling from Maryland.
I think so.
Yeah. From Wisconsin.
Why not?
From UK,
Canada,
from
UK, Australia.
Australia.
Yeah. Australia. Randy. Yeah.
We could just ride back with you, right?
I mean, oh, yeah, big luggage?
Can maybe you get well, a, I don't know. I can fit in a suitcase. Something.
I know.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not so much me. I guess it was really oversized.
We stuff Ken in the surfboard. The surfboard case. If you stay really rigid, you might make it.
I don't know. Most surfboards, I think, are a little skinnier than I am.
Me too.
Maybe length, maybe height-wise there. Yeah. You know, but.
Anyway, anything, all the good stuff that's happening, you can always go to wholelife.church/events. And that stuff is always in the show notes. And I also noticed that there was a new subscriber to the Slack channel. So welcome aboard. You know who you are. And so always check back there for everything else because that's where we post stuff. I guess that's it for this week. Hopefully we have two youngins. And then what's after that? After next week, are we into another?
We are. We're into a three-part series. I'm really excited about that.
Three-part series.
Yeah.
What's looking?
It's Melanie's time.
No, really?
Really? Yeah.
Really? What's the name of the, did we talk about this before I left? I feel like
we did briefly, but I think you have like vacation brains still. you are excused.
So what are we doing? What's up?
Yeah, we're going to talk about Jesus and justice.
Wow. Narrowed that right down, didn't we? But that's to be expected because she doesn't give out any details beforehand.
She still has 2 weeks to...
Don't wait till 2 in the morning.
To figure out what I'm going to say.
Don't wait till 2 in the morning.
Do my internet research at 2
a.m. I'm pretty sure she already knows what she's doing.
Yeah. You know what you're doing? You got them written? You good?
I'm part of the way there.
All right.
Well, yeah.
There we go. And so we're going to talk about Jesus and justice all 3 weeks or like one, then another? Then
well,
another?
there will be different angles. We'll take it from a few different
angles. Any other angles you want to talk about right now?
Nope.
I'm telling you.
It's a good try, though. You get an A for effort.
Then after that, we have our November series, which is on the prophet Elisha.
Oh.
That'll be is it a 3 or 4 part? I think it's a 4-part.
That sounds like fun.
Isn't it a 5-part?
Ooh.
Is it? Is it that many?
Elisha was second, right? It was Elijah, then
Elisha. Elisha, then Elisha.
Yeah, Elisha.
So,
I used to get that screwed up all the time.
I don't know. I think it's a 4-parter. Nice. And then we jump into our Christmas series.
Can it be that close already, you guys?
It really is.
Already.
September.
And then we jump into our 100-year anniversary year.
Tomorrow's the
2026.
Tomorrow is the first.
October. When you hear this, it'll be October 1st.
Rabbit.
Ooh, Ken sneaks it in before the bell. So with that, guys, thanks for listening and have a great week.